When we look out at the universe, there's a whole wondrous universe to discover out there. There are galaxies, both like our own massive Milky Way, as well as those more massive and in different shapes, and many, many more galaxies that are lower in mass. Some of these galaxies are harder to find because they're in very low density environments. But these small galaxies, these smaller siblings of ourselves and other galaxies in our local group, can teach us a tremendous amount about where we come from and how things got to be the way they are in our universe today. What can we learn by looking at these tiny galaxies in the nearby universe? Find out on this edition of the Starts With a Bang podcast. All throughout the universe, no matter where you go, you're never going to find a large region of space that's truly empty, that's completely devoid of matter, of radiation, and of some type of particles that exist and stream through it. And here to help us look at some of these low-mass galaxies, some of these more sparsely populated regions of the universe than the galaxy we live in, I'm so pleased to welcome to the program Dr. Mia De Los Reyes. Mia is a PhD astrophysicist. She got her degree from Caltech and is currently an assistant professor of astronomy at Amherst College in Massachusetts. Mia, I'm so excited we get to have this conversation and welcome to the program.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm so excited to be here.
So let's start out with some really basic stuff. I remember You might laugh at this, but I remember when I was getting my PhD some 20 some odd years ago, we were taking a look at, you know, what's in our local group. And the conventional wisdom was, okay, we have the Milky Way, we have Andromeda, they're the two big ones. And then you have Triangulum and the Magellanic Clouds and a few other like smaller sized galaxies. And then there were these tiny little dwarf galaxies. And back then we said maybe there were 50 or 60 galaxies all total. The last time I looked, we were well over 100 and I think closer to 200. And chances are, there's probably even more of these very, very tiny galaxies located nearby. When you think about the universe today, what do you think of in terms of, okay, there are these tiny galaxies out there, these much smaller than Milky Way sized galaxies, but how many of them are there and where can we find them?
That is a great question, and it's definitely still an open question. So as you said, for every Milky Way mass galaxy, and here the Milky Way has maybe, in terms of mass, the Milky Way is about 100 billion times the mass of the Sun, if you just count the stars in the galaxy. And these dwarf galaxies, what we call these very low mass galaxies, these can be anywhere from 100 to 1,000 times less massive than the Milky Way. Or even less massive. We actually are still trying to figure out what exactly is the defining line between just a cluster of stars that are sort of all born together and an actual galaxy. So, as you said, now we think that there are on the order of, you know, at least hundreds of those small dwarf galaxies within just our local group. But our local group is still quite a small sample. If we think about, you know, all of the possible environments that a galaxy could live in, there could be many more dwarf galaxies in these very dense galaxy clusters. So compared to our Milky Way, which, as you said, the only massive galaxy nearby is the Andromeda Galaxy, there are these much more dense regions of space called galaxy clusters, where there are many massive galaxies all living together. And so you can imagine that the population of low-mass dwarf galaxies in these denser regions might look different. And so we don't actually have a very good handle on that. One problem with these small dwarf galaxies is that they're very faint, they're small. And that makes them really difficult to see beyond our local environment. So that's what I like to do. And my goal really is to try to understand how these low-mass galaxies form and evolve in all different kinds of environments. And that's easiest to do within our local universe.
You know, one of the things I always worry about, and I'm sorry to get to a worry right away, but one of the things I always worry about is the small galaxies, the smaller they are, the easier they are to gravitationally destroy, right? If you have less mass holding you together, then when you pass by a massive object, you're going to experience what are known as tidal forces. So I worry that if you take something like our local group, which is relatively small and low in mass compared to these big galaxy groups and galaxy clusters out there, we're much less massive than even like the Leo group of galaxies, which is pretty modest, and the Leo group is way less massive than a big honkin' cluster like the Virgo cluster or the Coma cluster, which are two nearby clusters of galaxies that might have thousands of Milky Way-sized galaxies within them. I would worry if we're looking in these rich cluster environments, we might find, oh yeah, there are more dwarf galaxies in there than there are in here, but also a bunch of them got destroyed. A bunch of them are nowhere to be seen because these are rich gravitational environments. That's like playing a very, very destructive game of pinball, where these pinballs just kind of like get tidally torn apart or absorbed or what we call cannibalized. And that would make me want to ask, well, what about outside of groups and clusters entirely? Would it make more sense if we could look at these what we call void regions? Like if the universe is a cosmic web of structure, would it make sense to look at the giant holes in the cosmic Swiss cheese to look for these low surface brightness, low mass, tiny galaxies? Or do you have to do it all?
Right, great question. So I guess for context, these low mass dwarf galaxies are interesting, first of all, for a lot of reasons. So we think that they're the building blocks of a lot of the more massive galaxies like our Milky Way. They're also useful tools if we want to answer fundamental physics questions like the nature of dark matter. So we do care actually a lot about these seemingly insignificant low-mass galaxies. And as you said, they are one of the biggest issues with using these dwarf galaxies as physical laboratories is that they are extremely susceptible to environmental effects. So we see that in our own local group. If we look at the outermost halo of the Milky Way, this is the sort of smattering of clouds, or of, if we look at the halo of the Milky Way, which is sort of the smattering of stars that are in a sort of large spherical halo surrounding the Milky Way, we actually see remnants of old dwarf galaxies that have been accreted onto the Milky Way and sort of been torn apart through these tidal effects. So we know that this happens, and this makes it incredibly difficult to model and physically interpret what's happening to a lot of these dwarf galaxies. So for example, if we want to try to figure out the internal processes in a dwarf galaxy, it can be really difficult to disentangle what's happening internally in the dwarf galaxy from the environmental effects, from these tidal effects. And so studying our local group and studying more dense regions can make that especially difficult because we expect more environmental effects there. So yes, looking at very underdense regions of the universe, such as these cosmic voids, which are very large. When I say large, I mean on the order of 10 megaparsecs in radius or larger. So these are, I guess to put it in context with the rest of the universe, we expect that on the order of maybe 90 to 95% of the mass of the universe is in these sort of cosmic filaments that make up this grand structure called the cosmic web. And between those filaments are these void environments. And for a long time, I think these voids were really overlooked, partly because if you're looking at a very empty region of space, right, if you're trying to study galaxies, why would you pick a really empty part of space to look at? You want to pick the part that has the most galaxies. But now that we're realizing that environmental effects play such an important role in dwarf galaxy evolution, looking at void environments and the dwarf galaxies within these void environments is actually a very fruitful way of understanding dwarf galaxies, because it allows us to disentangle the effects of what's happening internal to the galaxy versus all of these environmental effects.
Well, I wanted to ask, so are you saying that if you have a richer environment, like a rich galaxy cluster, with big galaxies in it, we we know that galaxies primarily grow in two ways. They grow from mergers with other galaxies, including major mergers, which are from comparably sized galaxies, and minor mergers, where they just kind of gobble up the smaller galaxies around them. But they also grow by accretion. They also grow by just slowly gravitating and accruing more and more of that intergalactic matter onto them. And these are the two main ways galaxies grow. And, you know, some galaxies grow more via one way, some galaxies grow more via the other way. Some galaxies, we think, grew by mergers more dominantly early on, and then grew more by accretion later on. So I would imagine that when you look at these sort of rich cluster environments, you're seeing environments where you're not getting a very pristine dwarf galaxy. You're getting a dwarf galaxy, if you're getting one at all, that's been affected by interactions with its neighbors, that's been affected by matter, that's been ejected from AGNs and other cataclysmic phenomena that have thrown enriched material back into the, you know, interstellar and even intergalactic medium for them to interact with. Whereas if you look in these cosmic voids, you're seeing a dwarf galaxy that's had a quieter history, that hasn't had as many of these interactions. And so I would bet if you start doing large population studies that this would be something you'd want to investigate and see, well, how are dwarf galaxies different in terms of what's in them, in terms of what their dark matter profile looks like, in terms of how their heavy elements are distributed across the galaxy, that you would see differences between dwarf galaxies that have had a relatively quiet history, like from a cosmic void, versus dwarf galaxies that have had perhaps a rather violent history, like you might expect in a rich cluster of galaxies?
Yes, exactly. So I think in Lambda CDM, which is sort of the canonical cosmological picture that we have of the universe, the best model that we have so far, under this Lambda CDM paradigm, we expect that galaxies grow primarily through interactions with other galaxies and with their surrounding environments. And so dwarf galaxies in cosmic voids are conventionally thought to be evolving much more slowly than galaxies that are located outside of cosmic voids. And so this is actually really interesting. If we want to understand what the early universe was like, the galaxies in the early universe were also thought to be relatively low-mass galaxies that hadn't evolved much yet. And so really, in a lot of ways, these dwarf galaxies and voids are useful analogs for the earliest galaxies in the universe. They're sort of very slowly evolving fossils compared to the rest of the universe that was evolving much more quickly. So that's another great reason to study these dwarf galaxies and voids. And then you mentioned sort of a pristine environment. That's also true. So these dwarf galaxies and cosmic voids, because their environments are so clean and not as messy as dwarf galaxies in groups or in clusters, that makes them really good targets for comparing with simulations. So computationally, it's so difficult to model in detail a full galaxy, just because of the huge range of physical scales that it requires, right? If you're trying to track every single star in a Milky Way mass galaxy, that's on the order of 100 billion different particles that you have to track over a huge range of physical scales. And that's just computationally infeasible. And it gets a little better if you look at lower mass dwarf galaxies, because there's less mass that you have to track. But it's really difficult to model a full dwarf galaxy and all of the complicated physics inside of the galaxy, while also modeling the dwarf galaxy's environment. And so a lot of the most detailed simulations that we have of dwarf galaxies really only focus on isolated dwarf galaxies. And so if we want to directly compare against these simulations, we really need dwarf galaxies that are in relatively isolated environments to do sort of a direct apples-to-apples comparison.
You know, that sounds like a great idea, but I always worry whenever and this is not unique to you, I worry about this as a theorist anytime I talk to an observer about the fact that, you know, when we observe the universe, we're limited by what it gives us to look at, right? The universe is a great laboratory, but it's not a laboratory we can control. It's just a laboratory that, you know, space is big and it's full of a lot of stuff. And so we have a lot of things to observe, but it's not like we can say, oh, I want to look at a dwarf spheroidal galaxy with this specific mass and this pristine of an environment as it was 1 billion years after the Big Bang. Like, I'm sorry, we don't get that. What we get is whatever the universe gives us. And so I understand that we can do things like we can look at a galaxy as it is today, and by looking at the stars inside of it and looking at how, you know, how it's relaxed, which is to say how its density profile of both normal and dark matter looks, and how, you know, what the time scale is for an orbit of both a dark matter particle and maybe a clump of normal matter, we can reconstruct some things about it, but we still only get this snapshot in time of this galaxy. And as pristine as they are, we know they're still polluted in some sense, because they too have had 13.8 billion years of cosmic evolution, and all we see are the survivors. If I were someone who was starting grad school and I said, I'm interested in studying these low mass galaxies, what are the big questions I should be asking? What are the big questions that we all would want to know answers to?
Wow. What a question. Oh, man. There's so many. I can think of so many potential PhD theses off the top of my head, because there's really just a lot we don't know about dwarf galaxies. I think one of the biggest open questions, and one that a lot of people are working to try to answer now, is just how special is our local group and the dwarf galaxies in our local group? For so long, as you said, we've been limited by what the universe shows us. And because we've been limited, we can't see very far. Well, nearly great. Because dwarf galaxies are so faint, you can't see them out. I'm trying to think of a good way to phrase this. So dwarf galaxies are, by definition, much fainter than their more massive counterparts. They have fewer stars. And that makes it difficult to see dwarf galaxies that are much further away. And so for a long time, we've really been limited in our detailed studies of dwarf galaxies. We've been limited to just the dwarf galaxies in the limited radius of the local group. And as a result, a lot of our theories of galaxy formation and evolution at the low mass end, and a lot of our simulations, for example, are really heavily reliant on the observations that we've made of the local group. But if our local group is a small sample, and if it's a biased sample, if it's not truly representative of all dwarf galaxies, then that means that all of our theories of galaxy formation and evolution are also biased. And so I think just trying to figure out how special our local group is, putting it into the context of other local group-like environments, or even other local group-like environments, or just other environments in general, just trying to get more observations of dwarf galaxies across a huge range of environments outside of our local group. I think that's alone. I mean, there are so many directions that you could take that. You could ask questions about how star-forming are these dwarf galaxies. This is a big question that's come up recently, because some studies have found that in systems like our local group, the dwarf galaxies in those local group analogs are actually much more star-forming than expected. And that's when we compare to the local group, for example. And so that's a big open question. So where is this discrepancy coming from? Do we see it in all surveys, or is it just one or two of these surveys? Is it an observational effect? Is it a statistical effect? Or is it a real physical effect? Does it really mean that our local group is biased somehow?
You know, that's a big thing that I would expect would vary even within our local group. For example, if I looked at the larger small Magellanic clouds, which are both dwarf galaxies, but they're dwarf galaxies that are within about 200,000 light years of the Milky Way, they're pretty close by us. I would expect that those galaxies, just like the galaxies that are nearby in orbit around Andromeda, that those would be highly influenced by the environment of having a much larger, you know, honestly, bully of a neighbor saying like, oh, I'm going to exert my tidal forces on you and I'm going to pull your gas into filaments and sheets and make it collapse and form stars. I would expect that those types of dwarf galaxies would look very different than maybe an isolated dwarf galaxy like WLM, which I think stands for Wolf Lundmark Melotte, maybe.
I never actually known, so that's as good a guess as mine.
Okay, but that one is something like, yeah, it's like 3 to 5 million light years away from our Milky Way and Andromeda and any large galaxy. I would expect that the more isolated your dwarf galaxy is, even in the local group, that it would have very different behavior and properties from a galaxy in the vicinity of another large galaxy. And, you know, asking what's the, because it seems like one of the questions we still don't know the answer to is, what's a typical dwarf galaxy like? Do we even know enough to say what a typical dwarf galaxy, like what types of properties it would have, whether it has a big neighbor or whether it doesn't have a big neighbor, or is that completely environment dependent?
So within our local group, we have we have a pretty good understanding of the effect of having a nearby massive galaxy. And the main effect has to do with the gas, as you said. If a dwarf galaxy comes too close to a massive host, the gas in the galaxy can be heated or it can even be totally removed from the galaxy. And you need gas, and you need cold gas in particular, to make stars. So if a galaxy gets its gas removed, or if it gets heated up, then it can no longer make stars. So within our local group, we see sort of a bimodal population. The dwarf galaxies, with some exceptions, like the Magellanic Clouds, which we mentioned earlier, the dwarf galaxies closest to the Milky Way and to Andromeda, what we call sort of satellite galaxies, these are within the gravitational potential of these massive galaxies. These satellite galaxies typically have had a lot of their gas removed, and so they're no longer forming stars. And really, they kind of look like spheroidal blobs of stars, and so we call them dwarf spheroidal galaxies. And then if you look outside the virial radius of these massive galaxies, so sort of beyond the gravitational influence of the Milky Way and Andromeda, we start to see dwarf irregular galaxies. These are galaxies that do still have their gas, and they are still forming stars. And so any theory of galaxy formation and evolution has to be able to explain this bimodal population. And the easiest answer is tidal interactions. Again, with some exceptions, the Magellanic Clouds are large enough that they're not quite undergoing the same, they're not quite devoid of gas yet. So we see this bimodal population, and that has sort of raised a lot of questions. So even though we know that tidal interactions are likely the culprit, it's still not totally clear to us how exactly these dwarf galaxies formed in the first place. So if these galaxies formed in isolation, did they form as sort of disc-like systems, or were they already born as sort of these puffed-up spheroidal-like systems? And for a long time, the conventional thinking was that dwarf spheroidal galaxies were these really puffy systems, so the stars in these galaxies were mostly dominated by random orbits, so not really ordered motion of any kind. Whereas dwarf irregular galaxies were more ordered, at least in terms of how their stars were moving. Their gas might be a little irregular compared to sort of the nice spiral galaxies that we see at higher masses. But for the most part, this comes from a classical theory of galaxy formation, which says that all galaxies formed as these sort of rotationally supported, very ordered motion disks. And so this led to a bunch of hypotheses. One of these is called the tidal stirring hypothesis. The idea is that dwarf galaxies form in isolation as disks, and then when they interact with a more massive host, these tidal interactions end up puffing up these galaxies into these more spheroidal puffy systems. So understanding the motion of stars in these galaxies has been an ongoing, like, we see this really clear distinction in the gas. We know that the galaxies closest to the Milky Way no longer have gas, and the ones further away do. But understanding the motions of stars in relation to that gas is still sort of an ongoing process.
This is fascinating. You're listening to the Starts With a Bang podcast with your host, Ethan Siegel, and our guest this month, Dr. Mia De Los Reyes. Today's episode is brought to you by our sponsor, Avenues Online, the virtual campus of Avenues The World School. Avenues Online is an accredited Tier 1 private school designed for students from toddler through 12th grade who want to pursue a world-class education freed from the constraints of a physical school. Learn alongside peers living on 6 continents and in more than 20 countries with a global faculty leading the way. Learn more at avenues.org/SWAB. And now back to our program. So Mia, I love this idea that, look, you're going to form at least some of these dwarf galaxies from a relatively isolated environment, right? I view this the same way I view monolithic collapse, which is just, look, you have a clump of matter, it's in a slightly overdense region, and because it's gravitationally growing, right, it's, if you're a little denser than average, you're going to preferentially attract more and more matter from your surroundings, and that's going to make you a little bit bigger of an overdensity, and you're going to continue to attract more and more matter until you reach a large enough mass that you're going to gravitationally collapse and become gravitationally bound. But if our current consensus picture of the universe is right, which is to say, our universe is a mix in terms of matter, of dark matter and normal matter, and that dark matter dominates by about a 5-to-1 ratio, this means when your matter collapses, the normal matter is basically going to go splat in the middle and form stars. And when it forms stars, it's going to heat up the environment, right? Especially those blue, hot, massive stars that are short-lived, they're going to emit tremendous amounts of radiation. And if I'm not in a big, massive Milky Way-like galaxy, but in a tiny, low-mass dwarf galaxy, a lot of that radiation and a lot of those stellar winds are going to push that normal matter from this powerful radiation forces, they're going to push that normal matter all the way out of the galaxy. They're going to push it out beyond the gravitational potential well that keeps the galaxy bound together. None of the dark matter is going to be expelled that way, but a significant amount of the normal matter can get expelled that way. So I'm sort of curious, you know, in a galaxy like the Milky Way, we see it's consistent with that same 5-to-1 dark matter to normal matter ratio that seems to hold on large scales, and bigger galaxies show this too. But is there a point where you go down and down and down in mass where you start to see sort of this enhancement where if you measure how fast the stars are moving around inside this galaxy, you start to see, oh, wow, once you get below a certain mass or a certain size of dwarf galaxy, the dark matter to normal matter ratio gets really large, like it's significantly enhanced compared to that 5-to-1 baseline. Is that something that you see? And if so, have we been able to pin down where that occurs?
That is a really good question. So yes, we do see that dwarf galaxies have a higher proportion of dark matter compared to more massive galaxies. The exact point at which that happens, you know, I don't know off the top of my head. I think it's a bit of a fuzzy boundary. I don't think there's like a sharp cutoff between dark matter dominated dwarf galaxy and a more typical Milky Way-like galaxy. But yeah, we do see on the order of some of these dwarf galaxies can have, instead of this typical 5-to-1 ratio of dark matter to normal matter, some of these dwarf galaxies can have ratios of close to 100 or more. And so that makes them really appealing targets for dark matter searches, for example. And it also means that the overall population statistics of these dwarf galaxies is actually a really useful way to test different theories of dark matter. So in the Lambda CDM picture, for example, this is the Lambda cold dark matter picture, which is, again, sort of our canonical theory of cosmology so far. We see that the number of dwarf galaxies in the universe is roughly consistent with what we'd expect from this cold dark matter picture. If we compare that to other types of dark matter, so for example, warm dark matter, this is dark matter that moves close to the speed of light, so at relativistic speeds. Warm dark matter makes it difficult to form a lot of these very small structures like dwarf galaxies. So dwarf galaxies are actually useful for helping us uncover the nature of dark matter itself.
One of the things I'm really curious about is we have this view of our Milky Way that it's sort of built up its heavy elements over time. These elements that, you know, are not just hydrogen and helium, which, you know, are much less interesting to astronomers because if you count by number of atoms, something like 98-99+% of the atoms in the universe are hydrogen and helium. But that little 1 or 2% that's oxygen and carbon and nitrogen and all of these other heavier elements, what astronomers just boringly call metals, this is really important to things like planet Earth and all the biological activity on it. Do dwarf galaxies have enough metals in them, enough of these heavy elements, to also have potentially Earth-like planets and interesting rocky worlds with complex chemistry and maybe biology in them? Or is this really only reserved for the more massive galaxies? Do we see that your abundance of heavy elements drops lower and lower and lower when we go to smaller mass galaxies?
Yes, so there's something called the mass-metallicity relation. This is just the relationship between how much mass is in a galaxy and how the abundance of overall heavy metals in the galaxy. And it's a pretty clear direct correlation. So the more massive a galaxy is, the bigger its gravitational potential, and the more it's able to hold on to heavy elements when they form. Compared to a dwarf galaxy, I think we talked about this idea of star formation and other activity in a galaxy that essentially throw out a lot of material from a galaxy and expel a lot of material. And if the galaxy doesn't have a large enough gravitational potential, it can't hold on to a lot of that material. And so that's definitely the case in some of these dwarf galaxies. They're much more metal poor. They don't have nearly as heavy as many heavy elements as a more massive galaxy like our Milky Way. I don't know if that means that these dwarf galaxies would not have Earth-like planets. I think there are enough questions about the amount of heavy elements needed to make... Okay, to be clear, we do see some metal-rich stars in these dwarf galaxies, but on average, they're much more metal-poor. So my guess is that we would see fewer of these Earth-like planets in dwarf galaxies. The exact number of how many fewer, I don't know off the top of my head. And it would also depend on the type of planet, obviously. I think we would still expect to see maybe gas giants and brown dwarfs, depending on if you count them as planets. Yeah. I think we would expect to see more abundance.
I think this is something, to be fair, that the exoplanet people are still figuring out. They just recently passed their first 5,000 exoplanet mark. And one of the more interesting things I learned from going through that is if you went and said, okay, I want to look for stars with planets around them, there's a huge relationship between metallicity of the star and whether it has planets or not. I think if you have more than about 25% the heavy elements of the sun, you're guaranteed to have a planetary system around it. I think as you go down from 25 to about 8% the amount of heavy elements in the sun, the fraction of stars with planets plummets. Like it goes from like almost 100% to like down to like very, very few. And then below 8%, I think there's only one candidate system that has planets around it. Now, this is by no means comprehensive, but it's kind of very interesting that our early results of stars within our own galaxy seems to show above about a quarter of the heavy elements present in our sun, everybody's got a planet. Everybody and their mother's got a planet. But below about 8%, pretty much no one has a planet. And that's kind of my motivation for asking this is, well, if we see this this relationship between metallicity and mass in dwarf galaxies, does that mean that, you know, you get small, small, small enough, and pretty soon you're talking about something where, yeah, you know, you might be able to make these big puffy planets made out of, you know, the light elements mostly, but if you want a rocky planet with a hard surface made out of heavy elements, you might be looking in the wrong place.
Yeah, in that case, then, I think, I didn't know those numbers, that's really interesting. A lot of these dwarf galaxies have, on the order of, we have this horrible notation for metallicity in the galaxy community. But to order of magnitude, a lot of these dwarf galaxies have, you know, less than 10% the amount of metals that are in the sun. And so given that, I would expect far fewer of these rocky planets to be in dwarf galaxies.
But one of the things you said that also had me interested, and you said this earlier, so we'll bring it up again to make sure I understood it right, is that a lot of these galaxies, even the low-mass dwarf galaxies, it's not like they form stars all at once, and then they ejected their gas, and now they're done forming stars. It seems like a lot of these dwarf galaxies have this sort of steady or quiescent positive non-zero rate of star formation that indicates they still have gas, that gas is still cooling and collapsing and forming new stars. Is ongoing star formation a really common thing in dwarf galaxies, even in these isolated dwarf galaxies down to, you know, as low a mass as we can probe?
Yes, so we do see that a lot of these dwarf galaxies, including the LMC and the SMC in our own local group, the more isolated dwarf galaxies, the dwarf irregular galaxies in the local group, and even in these, you know, extremely underdense environments like voids, a lot of these dwarf galaxies do have active ongoing star formation. But we do think if you go below a certain mass, star formation stops again. Like if you start looking at the very lowest mass systems. Okay, and that has more to do with an entirely separate process called reionization. So we know that in the early universe, the universe started out as, you know, this hot soup of particles flying around. So everything was ionized. And then as the universe began to cool down, a lot of the protons and the electrons began to pair up. And so the universe became neutral in terms of electric charge. But then at some point, the universe got ionized again. When the first stars and the first galaxies formed and turned on, the radiation from those very early stars began to re-ionize a lot of the gas in the universe. And we know this because a lot of the universe is ionized today. So at some point, this must have happened in the past. And we think that this early process of reionization heated up a lot of the gas, especially in the lowest mass galaxies. And again, these extremely low mass galaxies. So when, for a sense of scale, the Milky Way, as I said before, is around 100 billion suns in terms of its stellar mass. A typical classical dwarf galaxy, that's, when I say classical, I mean sort of the dwarf galaxies that we've known about for decades. These are sort of the, I guess, regular mass dwarf galaxies. Those can be anywhere from, I don't know, maybe a billion to 100 million times the mass of the sun. That was backwards. 100 million to a billion times the mass of the sun in terms of stellar mass. And when we go to the very lowest mass ends, these extremely low mass dwarf galaxies that I'm talking about, the usual term is ultra faint dwarf galaxies, those are on the order of 100,000 times the mass of the sun. So, you know, these are orders of magnitude smaller than the classical dwarf galaxies that we see in our local group. These ultra-faint dwarf galaxies, we think, don't have ongoing star formation anymore because their star formation got completely turned off when reionization happened and heated up the gas in those galaxies. Because their gravitational potentials were so small, that reionization essentially totally disrupted them. And so there's been a lot of interest in trying to find these ultra-faint dwarf galaxies because they're thought to be sort of fossils of this extremely early period in the universe, because they're essentially frozen in time from when reionization happened.
Wow. So I want to ask you about, I at least know one very extremely low mass galaxy, and it's named a Segue 3, S-E-G-U-E 3. And if I remember correctly, it's only got about 1,000 stars in it. Like, its stellar mass is super tiny. It's got about 1,000 stars in it. I don't believe it has any gas that we see in it. But when we look at how the stars in that galaxy are moving relative to one another, it allows us to infer that there's about 600,000 solar masses worth of dark matter inside that galaxy, which gives it one of the most extreme dark matter to normal matter ratios of any galaxy that I know of. Are you telling me that that galaxy, all of the stars within it, would have formed 13 plus billion years ago, and that what we're seeing today is just like we really are seeing a living fossil? We're just seeing the relic of all the stars that remain from having formed so very early on, and then having had all of that ultraviolet radiation surrounding them expel all of the gas and normal matter around them, so that it's just stars and dark matter and at that very old stars and pretty much nothing else?
Yeah, that's exactly what our current thinking is. One of the biggest difficulties is it's really hard to measure the exact ages of these stars. So we're pretty sure that this is the case, and that for a lot of the ultra faints that we're looking at, they're extremely old. Like you said, on more like, 13 billion years or older.
Yeah, you're talking like typical globular cluster age, and not the outliers that form stars later, but most of them that are like 12 plus, maybe even 13 plus billion years old for the ages of their stars. Only I imagine not only do you have in these dwarf galaxies as compared to globular clusters a wider spread in age in terms of when they formed, but the fact that you still have all of that dark matter rather than just a big massive collection of normal matter that formed a lot of stars, their dynamics are going to be entirely different as well.
Yes, that's true. So, I mean, sort of the dividing line between a globular cluster and a galaxy to first order is the amount of dark matter that it has. We think that galaxies live in dark matter halos, or in the case of very small satellite galaxies, maybe they live in dark matter subhalos, whereas the globular cluster is just a collection of normal matter that is not associated with a dark matter halo. And one of the big questions is whether or not you can we can observe a dark matter halo that doesn't have a galaxy in it. So this is sort of an ongoing quest to figure out, we've talked a lot about the ratio between dark matter to normal matter, and how as you go to lower and lower galaxy masses, we see that ratio go up. And so the question is, at some point, does the ratio go to infinity, where we have a dark matter subhalo that was small enough that it doesn't actually have any normal matter in it? And that's an ongoing question. We don't really know exactly what the lowest, so we found galaxies like Segue 3, but could we go even lower in mass? Could you find a dwarf galaxy that has on the order of hundreds of stars, but a huge dark matter halo? We don't know. So this is a big open question, trying to figure out what exactly the statistics are, the numbers of dwarf galaxies and the numbers of subhalos are at the very low mass end.
Huh. I wonder about this now, because I know I know at least when it comes to galaxies and clusters of galaxies, we have gravitational lensing studies that indicate that in addition to the big main dark matter halo and the stars and clumps of normal matter in there, that we also have sort of this substructure to dark matter halos, that it has these like sub halos that are clumps of dark matter within them. And I would imagine if you get to a small enough clump of dark matter in there, not only in a galaxy cluster or in a rich galaxy, but also outside of them, at some point you would get down low enough that you would say, yeah, there's just like a few stars in there, hundreds, tens, single digits, or maybe even none at all. Maybe all you have is sort of like whatever normal matter wasn't completely expelled by the radiation pressure from reionization. As far as I know, we haven't found any like that, but it seems like this would be a prediction of, you know, when our observational capabilities catch up, these should be things we're able to find.
Yes, exactly. And there are a few, as our observations of the Milky Way get better and better, now that we have satellites like Gaia, for example, that are able to very precisely measure the kinematics of millions or billions of stars within our Milky Way, we can start to do some of these searches for dark matter substructure within our own galaxy. But I think we are a long ways away from finding a dark matter subhalo that doesn't have any normal matter, any stars or any galaxy in it.
I mean, this is a big problem of being trapped in our own Milky Way, right? If you were out there in intergalactic space far away from any galaxies, you could be like, oh, I'll just look tens or hundreds or thousands of light years away and see what sorts of matter I find in this very sparse area around me. But here in the Milky Way, we're really in the thick of it, right? We're about 25,000 light years from the galactic center, and we are over 100,000 light years from being in true intergalactic space. So how can you, from our position where we are, find these ultra faint, ultra low mass things? It seems like we're lucky because we're here, and being in a Milky Way like galaxy is a good way for creatures like us to arise. But at the same time, if we want to learn more about these tiny things, these tiny building blocks. And I don't know if you said it or not, but one of the things I've read that I found remarkably interesting is when it comes to reionization in the early universe and how all of that neutral matter that formed less than a million years after the Big Bang finally got ionized and made the universe transparent to visible light, that something like 90 to 95% of those reionizing photons didn't come from the largest, brightest, most massive galaxies and all the stars that formed within them, but rather came from these dwarf galaxies, came from the little ones that all added together, that actually made up most of the reionizing photons in the universe.
Yes. Yeah, so it's interesting that these dwarf galaxies were both likely the cause of reionization, and in many cases were sort of disproportionately affected by reionization. It is both a blessing and a curse to be inside the Milky Way. On the one hand, we get a very close-up view of how galaxies like our Milky Way form and evolve, but on the other, it's difficult to figure out how that happened when you're inside of the Milky Way. And it also makes it difficult to look outside of the Milky Way. So when we do these searches for dwarf galaxies, the entire galactic plane is sort of off limits for us. We can't see any galaxies through the galactic plane. And so, you know, our view of the entire universe is limited to stuff that's above and below the Milky Way. And it can get complicated if you're trying to distinguish between, like, even if you're looking out of the plane of the Milky Way, there are still stars there. There's just a lower density of them. And you have to still distinguish between those stars and the gas and the dust in the Milky Way versus what we're seeing, the actual light that's coming from galaxies outside the Milky Way. So it is a complicating factor, but it's not impossible. And so one of the surveys that I'm leading, it's called the Dwarfs in Void Environments Survey, or the DIVE Survey, because that was the best acronym I could come up with.
I mean, astronomers love acronyms. If you have an astronomical survey and it doesn't have an acronym, you better get one.
Yeah, what even are you doing? And at least, okay, I would like to, all right, here's my hot take, which is that a lot of these acronyms are extremely contrived, and at least DIVE makes sense as an acronym.
I'm just pleased that your acronym is, it's four letters long, and each letter is actually the first letter of the four words in it. The ones that get me are the ones that strain it so hard that you're like picking the fifth letter out of the sixth word to make it, you gotta either get more creative with your language or you need a different way to name your mission.
Right. Yeah. So I think, you know, DIVE is not the worst possible acronym I could have come up with. So the DIVE survey is really aiming to, it targets these extremely underdense void environments, and specifically aims to study dwarf galaxies in those environments. And so I'm hoping that we'll eventually be able to get a large enough population, a large enough sample, that we can actually do population comparisons with the dwarf galaxies in our own local group, for example.
Gosh, those observations must be killer difficult to make, because even with the biggest telescopes we have here on Earth, and even if you use spectroscopy, like the spectroscopic instruments on these giant telescopes, are you even going to be able to resolve how, for example, individual stars are moving around? Or are you really going to have to do things like, well, okay, we look at the line width and we infer a velocity dispersion, and that's going to allow us to estimate the stellar kinematics as a function of radius? I would imagine that these observations you're making are really pushing the absolute limits of the biggest telescopes we have here on Earth just to be able to get something.
Yes, oh my gosh, this is one of my biggest pet peeves, is that there's a big difference between resolved systems, like you said, these are systems where we can actually resolve individual stars, and unresolved systems, which is pretty much anything outside of our local group, where the galaxy is so far away that all of the stars sort of get smeared into a blob. And so far, we have not done a very careful job of trying to connect resolved measurements with unresolved measurements. So DIVE, unfortunately, is looking at galaxies that are far enough away that we can't resolve individual stars, but we're trying to sort of bridge that gap by using this method called integral field spectroscopy, or IFS. Sometimes IFU data is what it's called. And the idea is that it's sort of like taking an image, except at every single pixel in the image, you have a full spectrum. So you're at least able to sort of resolve different parts of the galaxy. So it's sort of a bridge between, for example, what we do with JWST observations, where really you only have a single measurement for the entire galaxy, and what we do in the local group, where we can actually pick out individual stars. So this IFS data is sort of in between and trying to connect those two regimes. But it's hard, and it's still not quite a direct comparison. I think that with the advent of even larger ground-based and space-based telescopes, we'll be able to push out how far we can actually see resolved systems. And that will help a little bit. But I also think that, you know, the galaxy community really needs to reckon with the fact that if we want to really understand what's happening at the high redshifts, interpreting a single spectrum for a single galaxy is tricky. It's iffy. It's not the same level of detail that we get for a lot of these much nearer systems. And so at some point we have to figure out how to consistently measure quantities in a way that, you know, is not, what do I want to say? We have to figure out how to measure properties of galaxies. So for example, the motions of stars and gas in these galaxies, or the ages of stars, or how fast stars are forming in these galaxies, we need to figure out consistent ways of measuring them in resolved systems and in unresolved systems. We have to find a way to directly compare our measurements. And I don't think that's been done yet. And it seems like a very sort of niche problem, right? It's such a...
You know, you describe it as a niche problem, but it's kind of a universal problem. Like, it's a niche in the sense that this is how it specifically applies to your field, but every field has their own, I'll say, a distance ladder problem, where, okay, we can observe the things nearby, and the things nearby, we can study them really well. And so, for example, if I wanted to know how far away the nearest stars are, well, oh, I'll just measure it now, and I'll measure it 6 months from now, and my position has changed by 300 million kilometers, so relative to the more distant objects, I see how much it moves by. I've got a nice parallax measurement. I know how far away it is. If you have stars in our own Milky Way, or stars in a blob or cluster or whatever that's very close to ourselves here in the Milky Way, you can sort of directly measure whatever properties you want about it. But as you go farther and farther away, maybe you can't do that anymore. Now you can only measure properties of collections of objects, so you need a new technique. And presumably you want to go to a place where the techniques overlap and give you consistent results, and then when the closest technique peters out, you can reliably go to that more distant technique. And then if you're lucky, you'll get another technique that you can use to measure things that are even further away, and you can sort of find systems where both the second technique and the third technique apply and show that they're, you know, both good to this level, and then extrapolate out beyond that. But it sounds like this is something where even what I would say is the first rung in the stars in dwarf galaxies distance ladder is something that needs to be put into place, or needs to be firmly put into place, because, you know, one of the huge problems that we had and will likely always have in science is if you start to draw conclusions based on early results before you've got anything, or before you've got everything properly calibrated, you're going to get unreliable answers that can lead you into drawing all sorts of dubious conclusions. And no one wants to be in that situation. I mean, unless you know you're doing something that's totally sus and you're trying to get away with it, no one wants to be in that situation.
Yeah, absolutely. I would say that this particular distance ladder is very shaky at the moment. And I think, I understand there's a ton of excitement around the really high redshift galaxies that we're measuring with, that we're observing for the first time with JWST. But interpreting those results, I think, is really tricky business. And I think a lot of the people who work on that recognize it, and they're sort of doing the best that they can. But I think that's why, you know, even though there's a lot of high redshift excitement going on right now, there's still a lot of value in understanding the universe that's pretty local to us.
Well, yeah, I mean, there's this whole story, right, of where things came from, of where did we come from, and how did we get to be the way we are today? And I think that if you only look at the farthest systems you can see, or the, you know, when you look at those great distances, you're really only going to see the brightest objects that appear there. You're not getting the very faint galaxies that existed at those very early times, except for maybe a handful of very, very lucky observations you'll get where the gravitational lensing geometry is just right to see them. But even those, it's going to be a biased small sample. If we can actually see what's going on around us now, what's going on in groups, in clusters, between groups, in the intercluster medium, with dwarf spheroidal galaxies, what are their populations, what are their properties, what are their masses, how fast are the stars moving, what are their dark matter normal matter ratios, what's the mass metallicity rate relationship for them. If we can answer all of these questions about our universe today, that at least gives us a point for what are things like today. Because if we want to know how did the universe grow up, it seems like, boy, that's a really foolish question to be asking if you don't even know what the grown-up universe today looks like.
Right, exactly. Yeah, I completely agree with all of that. And I talked about this a bit earlier, but I think especially studying dwarf galaxies today, we expect them to be similar in a lot of ways to the high redshift galaxies that became galaxies like our Milky Way. And so it's sort of a complementary picture, right? We can directly observe these very high redshift distant galaxies, but not in a lot of detail. And we can try to compare that and connect that with the dwarf galaxies that we see close by, where we can get more detailed measurements. And so the hope is, you know, by doing things like calibrating this distance ladder, by understanding the properties of dwarf galaxies in a systematic way across different environments, we'll be able to eventually build up an overall picture of galaxy formation and galaxy evolution across the entire time scale of the universe.
Now, I'm going to ask you a question. It might seem a little out there, and if it does seem stupid to you, I apologize. But one of the things that people often talk about when they talk about the solar system is they look at asteroids and Kuiper Belt objects and potentially Oort cloud objects, and they say that these are fossil relics from the early solar system, right? That we know most of these objects formed about 4.5 to 4.6 billion years ago, back when the solar system was forming, and they're relatively pristine, right? The ones in the asteroid belt, they've likely had some of their volatile ices boiled off just because they're in sunlight and relatively close to the sun, whereas the ones farther away might still have all of their pristine ices. But we know that even though these objects or objects very much like them contributed to the formation of planets like Earth, that's not the full story. It's not like if you took an Earth's mass worth of Kuiper Belt objects and smashed them together, you would wind up with something that looks like Earth. We know that's not the case. Do you have sort of these worries about the dwarf galaxies when it comes to how our Milky Way exists today, that we know that some substantial fraction of what went into building up the Milky Way came from seeds that were very much like these dwarf galaxies we see now, but that there isn't a one-to-one correspondence, that if we took, you know, a Milky Way's mass worth of dwarf galaxies and merged them all together, we probably wouldn't get a Milky Way-like thing. We'd probably get something that was vastly different. Is that at all a good analogy? And if it is, what are some of the ways that the modern Milky Way would be different from building a galaxy out of a Milky Way's mass worth of dwarf galaxies smashed together would lead you to believe?
So this is a good question. Definitely not stupid. And I don't have a good answer for it. When we try to, for example, simulate Milky Way-like galaxies, we put so many assumptions into, you know, modeling galaxies. There's just a whole scaffold of assumptions, and I don't know if anyone has ever really tried to, you know, take a bunch of dwarf galaxies today and smash them together and see if you could get a Milky Way-like thing.
Yeah, because I would imagine that these sort of evolutionary effects would really play a major role, that when we see a dwarf galaxy today, especially if we see a low mass dwarf galaxy that roughly has the same stellar content, just more evolved, that it had 10 or more billion years ago, that would look very different after 10 or so billions of years if it had merged into the Milky Way long ago versus if it's sort of merged into the Milky Way now.
Right. Yeah, I think that's a question that... So far I've been talking a lot about studying galaxies outside, dwarf galaxies outside of the Milky Way. But there is sort of an ongoing industry, especially I mentioned Gaia earlier, and its ability to measure the chemical abundances and kinematics, motions of stars within our Milky Way with unprecedented precision and in huge sample sizes. We're actually starting to... There's a sort of a cottage industry that's being built up of people picking out the remnants of dwarf galaxies that have been accreted onto the Milky Way and trying to study those and figure out, you know, the properties of the host dwarf galaxy from which these remnants have come.
Yeah, I've heard about some of this. I think there's a stellar stream around the Milky Way that I think they've traced back to what they call the Sagittarius dwarf galaxy. And forgive me that I know there are many Sagittarius dwarf galaxies, and I don't remember if it's the dwarf elliptical or the dwarf spheroidal or a completely different dwarf galaxy, but they found evidence that, like, oh, it must have passed by the Milky Way closely something like 6 billion years ago, and then it slingshotted away, and 3 billion years ago it was very far away, and then it came back in, and now it's sort of been stretched out into this diffuse stream that even loops around the plane of the Milky Way, but it's sort of in the process of being completely destroyed, but it hasn't reached an equilibrium state yet. Are these the types of galaxies and streams that people are looking at to try and sort of understand what happens to these galaxies when they are in a group near a massive Milky Way-like galaxy?
Yes, exactly. So these stellar streams, you mentioned sort of the most famous one, the Sagittarius stream, but I think we're on the order of, I don't know the exact number off the top of my head. I want to say less than 100, but still, you know, we're building up a pretty large sample of these stellar streams. There's a famous image from, I think, the Sloan Digital Sky Survey, which is called the Field of Streams, where you can actually see, I think, 10 or so of these stellar streams. I am making up numbers off the top of my head here.
No, but I'll do you a solid and I'll look up that image and see if I can use it. We get one image for our podcast and I'll see if I can have that to use as our cover image.
Yeah, sounds good. So I'm not a streams expert, but you know, several of my colleagues are, and that's another great way to study dwarf galaxies is by picking out these remnants of systems that have been accreted in the past. So a lot of them show up as stellar streams. Some of the more massive ones might have become more in equilibrium with our Milky Way, and so maybe they don't show up as streams, but as other dynamical features that are difficult to pick out by eye. But if you make plots of the different dynamical motions, so for example, like the velocity and the momentum of these systems, you can actually pick out distinct structures. Some of them can also tell us about dwarf galaxies that merged with our own Milky Way in the past. So that's interesting because it not only tells us about the properties of these dwarf galaxies, you can do science with, like, let's say you pick out a stellar stream and you're able to identify all of the stars in that stream that belonged to a dwarf galaxy in the past. You could do science with those stars. You could analyze those stars and that would tell you something about the properties of the dwarf galaxy itself. But you can also learn about the history of the Milky Way that way. And so we've begun to piece together a timeline of how our Milky Way formed and all of the different major and minor mergers that built up our Milky Way over time.
Yeah, I think I've seen that they've reconstructed like 5 major mergers that happened in our Milky Way's history, and those were all pretty much relatively early on. But we have a big one coming in our future, probably the most major merger that our local group will ever see, about 4 to 7 billion years from now. And that'll be when the Milky Way and Andromeda merge together. And from what I've heard, even though we're not sure what that finished galaxy is going to look like. We've got a name for it, and we've started to call it Milkdromeda, which I kind of like. But I'm also curious, if we have, you know, 100 plus galaxies in our local group that are mostly of this dwarf variety, what is our local group going to wind up looking like? Will we just be like this one massive Milkdromeda galaxy orbited by these dwarf galaxies, or will all of the dwarf galaxies on maybe tens of billions of years of timescales, will all of them eventually be cannibalized by big bullies like ourselves?
That's a good question. So I'd have to sit down and actually try to calculate dynamical times. But for example, the LMC and SMC are currently merging with the Milky Way right now. They're currently falling in. And as they fall in, they're also dragging a bunch of smaller dwarf galaxies with them. And that's already having a huge effect on the shape of the gravitational potential of the Milky Way. It's actually caused a warp in our galaxy's gravitational well, which is kind of wild to think about.
You know, you can't see it. My eyes just went wide because I remembered reading about that. And why did I remember reading about it? Well, surprise, surprise, because Gaia discovered it. So, yeah, like it sounds like this is a really exciting time for learning about our local universe and how it is still growing up.
Yeah, absolutely. And so when Milkdromeda happens, the Andromeda galaxy will drag in all of its satellites along with it, and that will also affect, you know, the overall gravitational potential of Milkdromeda. And I'd really have to sit down to like try to calculate how long the dynamical times are, how long the time scale that we expect, how long we expect it would take for this giant Milkdromeda system to finally equilibrate. I suspect that the major merger of the Milky Way and Andromeda would settle down faster than it would take some of these dwarf satellite galaxies to merge and settle. That is a purely intuitive guess. I really should just sit down and do a back of the envelope calculation.
Yeah, but that also makes sense, you know, especially if you consider that there are hundreds of them. I imagine some of them are in orbits that it's actually going to take them possibly several times the present age of the universe before they get finally drawn in to actually merge with the stars and gas of the Milky Way. Have we ever seen two dwarf galaxies, like, and the kinds that you're interested in, where you like, yeah, we have like these low mass, low stellar content, you know, 100 million to 1 billion solar masses or less. Have we ever seen two dwarf galaxies like that in relative isolation, except they're interacting with each other? Have we ever seen two dwarf galaxies in the process of merging and interacting? Because I would think that if you did see something like that, that would give you a set of information about the gas and the star-forming material that's present in those galaxies that would be very difficult to see when those galaxies were still in isolation.
I should know the answer to this question. I want to say yes. I want to say yes so badly, but I can't think of like an immediate concrete example. I mean, one of the big issues that we've talked about several times so far is that it's hard to see these dwarf galaxies. They're faint. And a lot of our galaxy surveys so far have been very incomplete, right? We know for a fact that a lot of the earliest galaxy surveys, like the Sloan Digital Sky Survey, which is sort of the first big one, it's not complete if you look basically in the dwarf galaxy regime. We know that these big galaxy surveys are missing a lot of galaxies. And so there's still a lot we don't know. I think we must have observed dwarf galaxies merging at some point. I just don't. Yeah. I don't know enough about it.
No, and I feel that way about almost everything, where people are like, you know more about this than almost anyone. I'm like, yeah, but it's still not enough.
Yeah, I think that's one of the most surprising things to me. I think when I started grad school, I actually wanted to study the high redshift universe because I thought that's where, a lot of exciting things were happening. I thought that was sort of the frontier of human knowledge. And it is. It certainly is a frontier. But there are so many things that we don't know, even about our local group and our Milky Way and our very local universe, the neighborhood near us, that I think there are just a ton of open questions. I think you asked me earlier what some of the biggest questions are, and there are just so many that I honestly.
No, I asked you an overwhelming question. I do that sometimes. Let me try and narrow down the scope a little bit. If you could make any observation that you envision is possible to make even decades from now, what would you want to be able to measure? And why? And also, what type of telescope or observatory would it take to make that measurement?
I know what I would like right now, and in the decades it would take to actually do this, my answer could change. So, with that caveat in mind, I think what would be really incredible is another extragalactic UV survey. So, ultraviolet light is especially useful for when it comes to galaxies. It's especially useful for measuring star formation. Because ultraviolet light is predominantly produced by the most massive, youngest stars, right? The most massive stars die very early. So if we see ultraviolet radiation being ultraviolet radiation from a galaxy, it's probably coming from these extremely massive stars, and they must be very young. So there must have been very recent star formation in that galaxy. And one of the big issues is that the last big extragalactic UV survey was done by GALAX, which was a, I think, mid-sized NASA mission.
Yeah, well, you have to go to space to make a good UV survey.
And that's one of the limiting factors. And so since GALAX, which I want to say was in the 90s,
I think it was about 20 years ago. It might have started in the 90s. You might be right about that. But are we going to have a good observatory that can do that before the Nancy Grace Roman Observatory goes up, or is Roman really the one that you'll say, look, it's wide field, it's UV, and we can at least get a lot of the sky with it.
Yeah, there are plans for sort of a spiritual successor to GALAX. I think there are several. The biggest one I can, oh, I've completely forgotten the name already. And I actually don't even know where it is in terms of funding and in terms of, I have it in my notes somewhere. I'm sure I could look this up, or you could look it up, and you can add something in post about it. But there are plans to have sort of another specialized UV mission, which would be able to do sort of a wide scale, a wide field UV imaging survey for galaxies.
Would it be important to get like an all sky type of thing so you're not missing anything?
Yes, I would like an all sky survey. I would like it to be, well, there's always the trade-off between, your field of view and how deep you can actually go, the dimmest that you can actually go. And to study dwarf galaxies, you have to be able to go quite deep in your observations. But you're right that it would be also nice to go as wide field as possible. So I think what I would love to see is a wide field UV survey, presumably from one of these, small to mid-sized missions, that is all sky or as close to all sky as we can get. And that would ideally help us pick out the systems that are the most interesting, like find dwarf galaxies that we would want to follow up with a deep space telescope, like not a deep space, a space telescope with deeper UV imaging capabilities, like habitable worlds or whatever they call it by that point.
Right. Sure, it's going to be renamed a couple of things that the community is going to shake our heads and scratch our eyes and say, how did you do this again? But we won't worry about that just yet.
Yeah, but I think I would really like to see that. Like I said, the UV carries a lot of information about recent star formation. And star formation is so difficult to characterize in dwarf galaxies compared to more massive galaxies. And that has to do with, in massive galaxies like our Milky Way, the star formation history is pretty smooth. So when I say star formation history, I mean if you plot the rate of star formation as a function of time, the star formation rate doesn't change very much in a galaxy like the Milky Way.
Yeah, I think the only real changes we've been able to observe that, you know, if you look at it overall for the universe, it was like there was no star formation in the beginning, and then it rose and rose and rose till it reached a peak about 3 billion years after the Big Bang. And then it steadily declined ever since, where today it's only about 3 to 5% of what it was up at its peak. And the Milky Way largely follows that as well, for as much as we can reconstruct it, with the exception of when we can identify, we had a merger with a galaxy that we call the Kraken about 11 billion years ago, and that made a little peak of star formation. And then about a billion or 2 years later, there was a merger with what we call the Gaia Enceladus galaxy, and that made another peak of star formation. But overall, star formation in the Milky Way is relatively constant. Those are a couple of blips. We don't expect that for dwarf galaxies, do we? We expect that it would be like, oh no, we had an enormous burst and then very quiet. And I don't think we've really quantified very well both what the quiet part looks like and what the burst part looks like.
Yeah, exactly. So the burstiness of dwarf galaxies is something that we're still getting a handle on, and UV measurements could maybe help with that, because again, UV traces really the most recent star formation. And so by comparing UV measurements with other measurements, which might tell us about sort of longer timescales of star formation, we can start to put together a more comprehensive picture of the histories of these dwarf galaxies.
I think that
would be really interesting.
Oh, I'd love to know that. I also think it's really interesting. You know, we don't think about this very often, but galaxies like our Milky Way and like Andromeda, like the big ones, they have overall, I believe, most of the stars in the universe at present. But there are only, you know, we talk about there being billions and billions, and nowadays we talk about there being several trillions of galaxies in the universe. But only a small percentage of them are actually like the Milky Way or Andromeda or bigger. Most of the galaxies, and by most, I mean like 99% or maybe even more than that, are these little ones, are these dwarf galaxies. That this is most of the galaxies that are out there in the universe, even though they don't have most of the stars. I'm not even sure if that's something that has been well quantified. The last I've heard, the arguments over how many of these small, low-mass galaxies are there in the universe, I think the estimates are off by more than a factor of 10 from each other. Like, some people think, oh, there are only 2 trillion total galaxies in the observable universe. And other people think, no, for every Milky Way galaxy that's out there, there are at least 30 and probably more than 100 little dwarf galaxies that are out there. I was wondering if you had any maybe up-to-date or better information about that than I do.
I wish I did. I do not. last time I checked, there's still some discrepancies, quite large discrepancies between different measurements, and I think it will get better. There are currently in this era of, you know, massive galaxy surveys, massive spectroscopic surveys, that will hopefully be able to help us answer that a little better. But part of the issue is that, you know, even the way in which we, the ways that we measure galaxy masses, for example, they're not perfect. We make a lot of assumptions when we do these calculations, and so that can have a huge effect on the overall, what we call the luminosity function or the mass function of galaxies, which just tells us how many of these small galaxies there are compared to the more massive galaxies.
You know, this has been a really fascinating discussion, and I wanted to thank you for sort of bringing to prominence these low mass, low surface brightness, and relatively nearby, but more than that, like completely ubiquitous in the sense that they're everywhere, dwarf galaxies. We often don't appreciate the smaller things that are in the universe, even though time and time again, we're being proven that those are the most common. We focus on the biggest, brightest, farthest things, but most of the stars are not like our sun. They're red dwarfs. Most of the galaxies are not like the Milky Way. They're these little dwarf galaxies. And most of the universe is not a big, overdense clump like we are. Most of the universe is a sparse, you know, hole in the cosmic Swiss cheese. And those holes in the cosmic Swiss cheese are likely where a large number of these dwarf galaxies are actually hiding. So Mia, I wanted to thank you for this tremendous conversation we've had, and I wanted to give you a chance to share any final thoughts you might have with our listeners out there at home.
Let me hop on a soapbox for it. It's related to dwarf galaxies, so it has to do with the names of some of these dwarf galaxies. So in particular, sort of the two most famous, and in a lot of dimensions, sort of the two most well-studied dwarf galaxies in the universe, one could argue, are the Large and Small Magellanic Clouds, which are the two most massive satellites of the Milky Way. I don't like the name of these galaxies. So the Magellanic Clouds are named after Ferdinand Magellan, who was a Portuguese explorer who led the first expedition to circumnavigate the globe. Magellan was also, I don't think it's a stretch to say this, Magellan was a terrible person who did a lot of terrible things on that expedition. You know, he encountered several different indigenous communities across the world, like around the world. His expedition stopped, for example, in what is now Patagonia, in off the coast of Argentina, and Magellan actively enslaved members of the indigenous community there. When his men landed in Guam and in the Philippines, they burned houses and killed their inhabitants. And in the Philippines, Magellan actually didn't even make it all the way around the world because he was killed in the Philippines. And all of these places ended up, although he was a Portuguese explorer, he was funded and sponsored by the Spanish monarchy. And so his voyage sort of laid the groundwork for Spanish colonialism in all of these places. So in South America, in Guam, in the Philippines. And Spanish colonization ended up causing a lot of suffering to these communities. So, you know, not only was Magellan like a pretty actively terrible murderer and slaver along the way, you know, his legacy is that of a colonizer, which is a really violent history for a lot of people around the world. And Magellan was also not an astronomer, so he didn't even discover these galaxies. He was not his expedition was by far not the first to discover these galaxies. Indigenous people across the Southern Hemisphere have had traditions and stories about these clouds, these two galaxies, for thousands of years, definitely predating Magellan. And so this is something that bothers me a lot, that, you know, these systems that I study and that a lot of my colleagues study have this name. It's not just the galaxies, there are also telescopes named after Magellan. There was a NASA mission that was sent to Venus that was named after Magellan. His name is just sort of all over astronomy, and that's upsetting to me, you know, personally.
Well, no, let me go into this. You know, I said this was a final thought, but let me ask you to sort of hone in on this. As a Filipina American, do you like, what do you personally feel when you just sort of casually encounter the name of this person who, you know, committed these atrocities against your ancestors? Like, do you feel like excluded, or do you feel like you're facing an uphill battle? Is that something you're comfortable talking about?
Oh yeah, I'm happy to talk about this. I wouldn't say that it's like a stab to the heart every time I hear Magellan's name, but it's certainly frustrating, right? There aren't... So I've actually searched, like I tried to find the indigenous community that Magellan encountered in Patagonia are the Tehuelche people. As far as I know, there are no Tehuelche professional astronomers today. There are, I think, no native... So the native people of Guam, the Chamorro, as far as I know, there are no Chamorro professional astronomers today that I could find with PhDs. I think they're PhD students, and I don't think the University of Guam even has an astronomy program. And then in the Philippines, so that's where my parents are from, in the Philippines, there are very few. There's a lot of interest in astronomy, especially at sort of the amateur level. But there's such a lack of access to resources that I think I'm certainly one of less than, I want to say, 10 astronomers in the world of Filipino heritage that have a PhD.
Wow. I didn't realize it was that small of a number. That is astounding to me.
Right. And it's not out of lack of interest, right? That, like I said, I think amateur astronomy is incredibly popular in the Philippines, and there's a growing demand for astronomy research and astronomy classes in the Philippines. But because of the consequences of historical colonialism, which again is tied to Magellan, Filipinos don't have the same access like, to astronomy research. To get a PhD in astronomy, you typically have to leave the country. And so hearing Magellan's name sort of casually used is, you know, it doesn't, you know, physically harm me in any way when I hear it, but it's another reminder of how difficult it is if you don't have that access to resources.
Yeah.
And on top of that, it, you know, a lot of indigenous astronomical traditions have been forgotten. Again, partly because of Spanish colonialism, right? When the Spanish came to all of these places, they undertook various policies of genocide, of cultural genocide in many cases, where, you know, they would try to stamp out indigenous traditions and cultures. And so a lot of those deep astronomical traditions have been lost or are being forgotten. And that is, I think, really upsetting, right? I mean, I'm trained in sort of the Western tradition of astronomy, but that doesn't necessarily make it, you know, any better or any more superior to all of these other ways of thinking about the universe. And yeah, so it's upsetting, I think. It's a reminder of how exclusive this club of professional astronomy can be. And I think if astronomers really believe that the night sky is for everyone, right, this is a refrain that comes up all the time when we talk about Starlink and satellite constellations, when we talk about access to astronomy education. It's a thing that comes up over and over again.
Right, and when we talk about clear and dark skies for everyone.
Exactly, right. And if we really believe that the night sky is for everyone, then surely the names that we call the objects in the sky should also not be names that alienate or isolate people. Anyway, that's my soapbox. That's my,
my one thing I want to bring up. Mia, I really appreciate you sharing those thoughts with us. You know, this is not the first time, and it definitely won't be the last time, that we have had people from all over the world, from all different cultures, countries, racial backgrounds, genders on the podcast. And one of the things that I think is really important is we talk all the time about how science is an endeavor that knows no international borders, that it is a collective effort by humanity to understand the universe. But if we really want to live up to that, then it's up to us to make sure that all of the historical things that have happened that have traditionally excluded people of certain backgrounds because they speak a certain language or because they're from a certain part of the world or because they look a certain way or they have a certain set of physical traits. Like, we don't just need to stop actively, you know, being engaged in those sorts of prejudices, but we have to do things to say, hey, we recognize that this is a part of our history and we are opening a space for people who have traditionally been excluded to participate. Because in the end, we know that we are all equally capable of doing this all over the world, that it's not like men or women or brown people or black people or white people or Asian people or any other skin color of people are inherently better or worse at this. It all comes down to access. And if we want to get the best science done in the world, then we need to provide everyone out there who's interested in this, who wants to do it, with the tools and the ability to pursue their dreams. And that means opening a space and means not doing the exclusionary things that have traditionally been done anymore. So thank you for bringing that up, and thank you for sharing your very relevant views on this with all of our listeners.
Thank you so much.
The Starts With a Bang podcast is only made possible due to our generous sponsorship from Avenues Online. Again, you can learn more about Avenues the World Schools by going to avenues.org/SWAB. I'd also like to mention to everyone that our Kickstarter for the Encyclopedia Cosmologica, where we tell the history of the cosmos one page and 100 million years at a time, is available on Kickstarter. You can pledge until Sunday, September 3rd. So if you listen to this before then and you haven't yet, go check us out on Kickstarter. And finally, I'd like to thank all of our Patreon supporters who really make the Starts With a Bang podcast possible. I'd like to give a verbal shout out to everyone who donates at the $5 a month level and above. Thanks go to Chad Marler, Jeff Bonwick, Lainey Chuist, Rob Hansen, Samir Kumar, Tim Graham, Aaron Weiss, Chris Jakutas, Dominic Turpin, John Methot, John Van Balaguyen, Matt Conroe, Pattern Shift, Pete Smoyer, Pierre Franson, Sea Green Mango, Stefan Bernegger, William Blair, Amira Sosnick, Andy and Wall, Benish Tech LLC, Brian Terry, David Charney, David Hibbets, George Church, John Kozura, Joseph Dvorak, Kilia Opu, Mark Armstrong, Matt Glasser, Patrick Dennis, Pedro Teixeira, Rafal Wojcik, Randall Slimak, Rick DeWitt, Robert Thibodeau, Ron Schiffman, Sean Foley, Steve Guderian, Adam Robinson, Adrian Griffiths, Alan Parikh, Andres Chovanek, Arnulfo Zepeda, Benhead, Bob Shire, Brainwise, Brett Minder, Cameron Sowards, Carl Ittings, Casey Haskins, Dan Steelen, Dana Bridges, David Taschioni, David Wolf, Diana Nevins, Dick Pills, Dwayne Williams, Flo, Fraser Kane, Girolamo Castaldo, Glenn McDavid, Ira Cohen, James Bryson Hyatt, James Nance, James Page, Jason Luttrell, Jason McCampbell, Javier Zazo, Kelly Kudrick, Lockwood Carlson, Mark Bergeron, Mark Bloor, Mark Langston, Matt Reno, Michael Hall, Michael Savuto, Naked Bunny with a Whip, Nathan Hannon, Neil Flood, Owen Mann, Pam Harris, Paul Lester, Pavel Zizelski, Philip Francis, Rich Weigel, Richard Schwartz, Ron Lyle, Rushin Shah, Steve Nordhoff, Stuart Lending, Tom Van Scotter, Tomas Hall, Tomas Walgren, Wayne Pierre Carr, Weller Tractor Salvage, William Vandenhuvel, and Young Co. S. Thanks to all of you for tuning in, and we'll see you back here next time for more Starts With a Bang.